Good morning, everyone. So today we're going to talk about perturbations to black holes. So I guess the basic problem we're interested in is, you know, if, for example, you take two black holes and merge them together to create a bigger black hole, or you take a black hole and you throw some matter in, then that'll temporarily disturb the black hole from this, you know, stationary Kerr solution, and it'll have some oscillations, some perturbations that will eventually die down. And I basically want to understand the behavior of those. So this is a rather complicated subject that we could probably spend a whole class on. So I'll just spend one lecture on it and sort of give you a feeling for the basic equations and intuition without sort of deriving everything. So really the thing we're kind of most interested in is understanding, perturbations to pure spacetime, that's metric perturbations. But just to kind of make things simpler, let's begin by just discussing scalar field perturbations on a black hole spacetime. And then we'll move to the gravitational wave case shortly. So let's say we have a scalar test field, so it doesn't back react. So just satisfies the wave equation box, or two covariant derivatives, phi equals zero. And here we're going to take the Kerr solution in usual Bohr-Lindquist coordinates. So written this way, we have partial differential equations, right? In general, this phi is going to depend on, all four space-time coordinates. And these equations will be coupled together, right? However, you can make a sort of nice ansatz that basically you can separate the equation into the different dependences on the different coordinates, and that'll actually separate the equations. And so you don't have PDEs, which are complicated to solve. You have ordinary differential equations, ODEs, which are easier to solve. So the ansatz you make, sort of the usual one you might be familiar with, for example, from quantum mechanics. I'm going to say there's some function determining the radial dependence, some function capital theta that encompasses the polar dependence, and then for the azimuthal dependence and the time dependence, you know, since we already have a stationary and axisymmetric spacetime, we're going to go ahead and write these in terms of these azimuthal modes numbered by, you know, contour number m, and then some frequency omega. So if we take this ansatz and plug it into this equation using the Kerr solution, we do in fact basically separate out the equations, and we get two equations, one for the radial part and one for the polar angle. So first the radial one. So this is the radial the radial equation. This omega is this omega here, the frequency. I'll define this lambda here in a second as a separation constant. And recall this delta, you know, from when we discussed the Bohr-Lindquist solution is just this product of R minus R plus and R minus R minus. So that's the radial equation, and then we also have the polar equation. So we have, so basically we can choose some omega, some m, and then we can solve these two ODEs separately for the polar dependence and the radial dependence. And we basically have some, you know, second derivatives and then some potential-like term here. You know, so you can see that even just considering the scalar wave equation, the equations are already getting a bit complicated. So first, let's just talk about what happens if we set the spin of the black hole to zero. So we just have a Schwarzschild black hole, then all of these, and we can set A to zero here. And basically the omega dependence is going to disappear in this second equation here. And if you squint in that, you might notice that this, once we set A to zero, this is actually just the equation defining the Legendre of polynomials. So those are usually labeled by this L quantum number. So basically we have that the angular dependence, which is theta times this I m phi omega, are just the spherical harmonics. That you're familiar with from example quantum mechanics. So that's when A equals zero. When you have a spinning black hole, I should also mention that the separation constant omega in this non-spinning case is just L times L plus one, where L is this polar quantum number. So in the general case where A is not equal to zero, these are slightly more complicated functions, which are called, instead of spherical, they're called spheroidal harmonics. But we can still find solutions to these, and they still sort of form a basis. But in this case, not only does it depend on the polar angle, but it depends on this constant C, which is this product of the spin of the black hole times the frequency omega. So for different values of C, you'll get different spheroidal harmonics. And when C equals zero, these spheroidal harmonics will just become the spherical harmonics. Our radial equation also simplifies too when we set A equals to zero. So for convenience, we can, yeah. We can write the radial equation for the Schwarzschild case like this, where here I'm transforming from the usual Boyer-Lindquist radius to what's called the tortoise coordinate, which you probably are familiar with. So that's related to the Boyer-Lindquist coordinate by this expression. So you can see at large r, this term wins, and this tortoise coordinate is asymptotes to the usual radial coordinate. But as r goes to 2m, this actually, the tortoise coordinate goes to minus infinity. So it kind of puts the black hole horizon at minus infinity and the spatial infinity at r goes to r star goes to positive infinity. Yeah, so I introduced this potential function here, which is that complicated thing, but now setting spin equal to zero. And so the potential is given by this. So you can see, in the iconal limit, when L is really large and this term wins, you just get sort of the same radial equation you expect for photon orbits. And here, so we have this extra term here, and I introduced this sigma. So for the scalar case, sigma is just 1. But we'll sort of generalize this equation to the non-scalar case in a second. Yeah, so let's call this equation diamond because we'll use it later. So in terms of these solutions, we can actually, for specific frequencies and azimuth numbers, we can write a general solution as a sum over those. Since we just have linear equations, we can always sum over. And do a Fourier decomposition to decompose an arbitrary solution into components at different frequencies. So that's the general solution to the wave equation. And here I've added these indices here to remind you that this radial equation, depends on the specific polar azimuthal angle quantum numbers you choose, as well as the frequency. And again, this also depends on L, and that's the independence. So that's the general solution for the wave equation. Any questions about that before we sort of talk a little bit about the equation for metric perturbations?
Could you repeat what S is?
Yeah, these S are the spheroidal harmonics. So they're the solution to this equation double star.
Okay.
So in when we set a equals to zero, or you set the frequency to zero, then those are just the spherical harmonics. But in general, they're slightly more complicated angular functions.
I see. And why do you call lambda the separation constant?
Right, because basically you get, for spherical harmonics, you basically have solutions for any number of these L's, right?
Yeah.
And then that number also gets included. The choice of L you make also affects the radial equation, right? So you can see that this lambda basically, tells you what polar quantum number you chose, and that affects what the form of the radial equation. So that's how the two equations talk to each other, basically.
So it's purely mathematical. There's no physical reason for calling this separation constant.
Yeah. So I mean, in the non, it's basically just the generalization of this L times L plus one term that you get, for example, when you do like the wave equation in flat space. Yeah, so that's the wave equation. So in a previous class, we wrote down the equation for a metric perturbation on an arbitrary curve background. But in particular, we're interested here in Kerr. So you can see that, in this form, it's kind of not obvious how to basically put the metric perturbation in a separable form. Because here we have this curvature term, which is going to be quite complicated. It's the Riemann tensor of Kerr. And all these different components are going to be sort of coupled together in some way. So in fact, it's basically not known how to separate this equation in terms of the metric in general for Kerr. So first we'll talk about how you can do it in terms of the metric for the special case of a non-spinning black hole, and then we'll talk about how you actually have to use slightly different variables in order to separate the linear perturbation equation around Kerr. Like instead of the metric, you have to basically use the curvature. Yeah, I mean, so you can easily write the metric perturbation in terms of some function of r and theta, and because we have axisymmetry and a stationary solution, just you do the usual composition in terms of azimuthal number and frequency, but you still would get sort of a PDE for this radial and polar dependence. Yeah, but so let's now separate. Sorry, let's now specialize to non-spinning. And so in this case, you can actually distinguish between two types of metric perturbations. One are the odd parity or vector type metric perturbations, which are known as Reggie Wheeler metric perturbations, and the other ones are the even or scalar type ones, which are known as Zirilli type metric perturbations. So first, the odd ones. Yeah, so you can show that basically for these odd parity type perturbations, you can write metric perturbation is this way. So this matrix just depends on the radial coordinate, and the theta dependence is here. So here this is to denote the spherical harmonic with angular number, polar number L, and just m equals 0, because our background is spherically symmetric. And then, and then to get these specific metric components, they're actually related to this function psi, which I'll define in 1 second. Yeah, so here psi, and I have a minus sign to just denote the odd parity. Is actually a solution of this equation here, the diamond one, but now with this sigma. So in general, sigma is actually equal to 1 minus S squared, where S is the spin. So we have spin 2, so this is minus 3 for metric perturbation. And we're not going to discuss this, but in fact, around Schwarzschild, you can show that vector perturbations, i.e., electromagnetism, also satisfies an equation like this with this potential, but then with sigma equals, I guess in this case, 0. So once you solve for this equation, then you can use that to compute these two metric components and then reconstruct the metric. And I'm not going to write down the whole expression, but there's another one for the even parity metric perturbations. Where you have some matrix that depends on R, and then the angular dependence is just the scalar one in terms of again the spherical harmonics, the azimuthally the axisymmetric ones. Okay, but again, this is just for Schwarzschild. So far we've been talking about just general solutions to either the linear metric perturbation equation or the scalar wave equation. So now we're going to talk. Now we're going to basically impose boundary conditions and look for specific types of solutions. So yeah.
In what sense are these odd and even?
Just under yeah, basically how they transform. If you like, let theta go to minus theta, yeah.
Okay, the functional sense.
Yeah.
How do you construct such a form for the odd and for the even?
How do people derive these equations?
Yes.
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that.
Does it mean that any function of r and theta can be written in a combination of the odd mode plus the even mode, right?
Yeah, so you'd be, I mean, with kind of suitable, like a suitable choice of coordinates, you should be able to like decompose an arbitrary metric perturbation into some sum of these odd and even modes for different L's. Yeah. Yeah, so now we're going to be interested in the question of, if we take a black hole, we hit it with a hammer, or we formed it from two black holes, so it's initially very distorted, and then we basically are interested in the process by which it settles down once you stop perturbing it. What happens? And basically, you can think of black holes as like bells. You can hit them with a kind of a hammer, some sort of arbitrary, some arbitrary frequency perturbation. But if you wait a little bit, on one hand, the perturbation will die down as the black hole settles down to its kind of preferred stationary state. But on the other hand, black holes, just like bells, will sort of have not natural frequencies that they like to oscillate with. So now we're going to talk about basically computing what are called the quasi-normal modes. So they're quasi-normal because they decay in time as well as oscillate. But we'll basically find that the modes that live the longest, there's basically a spectrum of modes, and some modes live longer than others. So in general, even under sort of a generic perturbation, if you wait a little bit, the ringing behavior of a black hole becomes sort of almost universal. Right, so to define these specific solutions, we're going to have to impose some boundary conditions. And we basically need an inner and outer boundary condition. So the first boundary condition that we're going to pose is basically, a physical one that any sort of physical causal perturbation should satisfy, and that's just that basically our wave be ingoing at the horizon. Yeah, because information should propagate into the black hole and not out of it. So that means as r goes to r plus, or in terms of our tortoise coordinate, r star goes to minus infinity, this radial function for the scalar, or this, I think it's called a master function psi for the metric perturbation, should go like e to the I omega r star, corresponding to ingoing wave. And then at infinity, we're going to impose the condition that we have just outgoing radiation. So in general, you could imagine some different situation where you send in some wave and then scatter it off a black hole. So that would be a different problem. But here we're basically interested in some isolated black hole that's settling down and just by emitting some radiation. So we're going to impose that we only have outgoing radiation, no incoming radiation. So we have they have these functions go like e to the I omega r star for an outgoing wave. So it's going to turn out that basically when we impose both these conditions and then look for solutions with different values of omega, we're basically going to get a discrete spectrum. There's only going to be a discrete number of allowed values for omega that can simultaneously satisfy these two boundary conditions. And these are going to be the quasi-normal modes. In general, there's a whole literature on how do you compute these quasi-normal modes, usually using some combination of numerics and analytics. So for class, we're just going to work through kind of a simple example using the WKP approximation that'll help you hopefully give you a little bit of physical intuition. So the problem we want to solve is basically to find solutions of this equation that satisfy these two boundary conditions. And here this QR star is just omega minus V of R star, where that's the potential that I wrote down. And yeah, so you know, we basically have some potential that kind of dies away at infinity, you know, reaches some maximum, and then you can also notice that potential is going to go to zero at the black hole horizon as well, right? So it's going to be similar to these kind of, you know, unstable light rings we had when we considered null geodesics. So you know, normally in the WKB approximation, you think of, you know, sending in some wave, right? And if it has energy, in this case, omega squared, that's kind of way above your potential barrier, then it'll sort of pass through. If it's below, then most of it will be reflected, and only a little bit will transmit through, right? But in this case, we're actually want to impose this only outgoing radiation, right? So basically, this this incoming wave, we actually want to be set to zero, right? So in some sense, we want to have the transmitted wave and the reflected wave be sort of comparable in amplitude and have no incoming radiation, right? So we can actually arrange for this to happen and actually still apply the WKB approximation if we basically consider the case where we have our energy to be very close to the maximalist potential. And yeah, in this case, we'll have sort of two turning points that'll be very close to each other and very close to the maximum of the potential. And then we'll basically solve for this incoming radiation to be zero. Yeah, so I'm going to call this point where the maximum of the potential occurs R star bar, and then so dV dr vanishes here because this is a maximum, and that means that we can basically expand this potential around this point, and we'll get some, and you know, the linear part will vanish, and we can just get the quadratic part and get some parabola. So in terms of this Q, we have some constant term, then the linear term vanishes because it's maximum, and we just need to look at the second derivative evaluated at R star bar. and then we get this quadratic dependence. Yeah, and so you can actually solve this equation given this parabolic potential exactly in terms of special functions. So I'm just going to assert that. So the general solution is some constant A times this D special function, which is actually called cylinder function, a parabolic cylinder function, which we don't really need to know the details of, but it's parameterized by this extra variable nu, which I'll define in a second. So here, nu is given by this, and z is basically a rescaled radial coordinate. So those are some complicated special functions that we don't really need to know about that solve this this mathematical equation. But the point is now we want to impose our two boundary conditions. So basically, we can impose this only outgoing radiation condition, and that'll allow us to determine this coefficient B in terms of the coefficient A. So that then we just have an overall amplitude to our wave, but then we still have this additional boundary condition that we want our mode to be incoming at the black hole horizon. Basically, we can only impose that on this solution if nu satisfies a special condition that it's equal to an integer. So it's 0, 1, 2, or some integer like that, which I'll now call n. And that gives us this discrete spectrum. So if we go remind ourselves what q is in terms of omega squared in v, and then plug in v for a tensor perturbation, then we get the following approximation for the frequencies in this WK B approximation. So that was a lot of math, but let's just remind ourselves of the physics here. So basically, you know, we kind of have this, unstable point where the potential vanishes here, and we're considering some perturbation that is kind of, localized around it. Its real frequency squared is basically approximately equal to the value of that potential at that point. So from the iconal limit, this would actually just be the frequency at which a photon would orbit for example, at the unstable circular orbit for a photon. It's in Schwarzschild, it's at 3m. But we have some perturbation that sort of sits here, but then it's exponentially decaying, basically because some of the perturbation is falling into the black hole horizon, and some of it is going out to infinity and giving you gravitational waves. And so, for example, if we solve this for, if we write down this approximation for the L equals 2 mode and the N equals 0, so that's usually referred to as the fundamental mode, you can see that as you go to higher ends, these are going to be more and more damped. You get a complex frequency. It's about 0.37 over m for the real frequency, and then 0.09 for the imaginary component. So you can see the oscillation frequency is kind of order one and it's the black hole mass, and it's pretty heavily damped, right? It's gonna, on a few oscillation times, it's gonna undergo an e-folding time as well. So black holes are kind of very good at damping away their oscillations. And so in fact, you'll get this whole spectrum of quasi-neural modes with different real and imaginary frequencies, and you'll get different families for different angular numbers as well. So in general, these quasi-neural modes are usually labeled by L, M, and N quantum numbers. And here we're just taking the convention that a negative imaginary number means that it decays exponentially. And there are no unstable modes for Kerr black hole. They all decay. So any questions about that? So we still haven't talked about how one can basically find a separable equation, a set of ODEs for a metric perturbation in the general non-spinning case. In the kind of last 15 minutes of class, I'll just briefly sketch how that's done. So it turns out that instead of working directly in terms of the metric perturbation, you actually need to use the Weyl tensor. So let me define the Weyl tensor. It's basically the component of the Riemann tensor that is not encapsulated in the Ricci scalar or the Ricci tensor. Okay, so this defines the viol tensor here. You can basically see that we can take our Riemann tensor and write it in terms of the Ricci scalar, the Ricci tensor, and then the part we have left is the viol tensor. Of course, if we're considering vacuum solutions to the Einstein equations, then the Riemann, the Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar are zero. So the viol tensor is just the same as the Riemann tensor. So Newman and Penrose basically introduced the set of scalars, which you can get by projecting the viol tensor in terms of a complex null tetrad. So it's basically this tetrad, kind of, you can think of defining coordinates. They have a set of these Newman-Penrose scalars, which are numbered psi 0, psi 1, psi 2, and so on. And then we'll in particular be interested in the one called psi 4, which it turns out will encode the outgoing radiation. So that's defined by taking the viol tensor and projecting it with this null tetrad. In general, these are given by and here I've introduced this rho, which is given by 1 over r minus 1a sine theta. So these are a little bit complicated, but sort of roughly you can think of this n vector corresponds to ingoing null, the ingoing null direction. There's another one which we don't use here, which is called L, which is the tetrad corresponding outgoing null direction. So roughly in the wave zone, that's t in the t direction and the r direction. For outgoing, and this MA is basically the angular component that's orthogonal to the radial direction. So that's a component in the theta direction and then an imaginary component in the phi direction. If you basically work out what this is in the wave zone, so where we can write things in terms of the TT gauge, this asymptotes to here are two dots for two time derivatives. So Kokoda in the phi phi direction and the theta theta direction. And then one in the theta phi direction. So basically these are the two, the plus and the cross polarizations that are orthogonal to the, you know, that are transverse to the outgoing radial direction. So basically if we have psi 4 at future null infinity, we can use it to reconstruct what the metric perturbation or what the gravitation wave signal is, basically by integrating it twice in time. So the sort of the trick that is actually due to Tucholsky was to figure out that if you write down the equation for like a linearized deformation of Kerr in terms of these Newman Penrose scalars, then in fact you do get separable equations. You don't have PDEs, you have ODEs. And so in fact you can write the general solution to psi 4 as follows. So there's extra factor of rho, which I defined over there, to the fourth power. And then again, we can sum over different frequency components. Here we have the spheroidal components, but not for spin zero, the scalar ones, but generalized to spin two. Oops. So we basically get something that looks a lot like the scalar equation that we wrote down up there, but you just have sort of slightly more complicated potential terms for this radial one. And again, you get these angular functions, which are a generalization of the spheroidal harmonics, this time for spin weight two. And you know they depend both on the polar angle and on this product of the black hole spin and the frequency. Right, so you can again solve this and get these quasi-normal modes for the black hole spinning case. And actually, it turns out that the least damped one around a spinning black hole is the is the L equals M equals 2 one, and we can label it as the fundamental mode with these ends. So you can sort of, again, in general, one wants to solve for these quasi-normal modes sort of semi-numerically, but here's a sort of empirical approximation for this 2-2 mode as a function of spin. So this basically just shows you, oops. No, that's the real component. And the quality factor, which you can which we are defining as the real frequency divided by twice the imaginary frequency. So you can think of a very high quality factor means that black hole would oscillate many, many times before decaying, and a very a low quality factor mean just a few oscillations before the perturbation dies away. So sort of a approximation for that is given by the following. And so just to plug in some numbers, let's consider a spin 0.7 black hole. So for example, if you take two equal mass black holes and merge them together, they form a final black hole with a dimensionless spin of 0.7. The real part of this 2.2 frequency is about 0.53. And the imaginary part is 0.081. So we can see the frequency went up a little bit compared to this m=1 for non-spinning, and the damping rate went down a little bit. In general, if you have a spinning black hole, the least damped quasi-neural modes are damped slower for more rapid spin. Right, and you know the fact that this these quality factors are kind of order one, you know, basically means that you know, when we have a black hole merger, for example, we have this like increase in frequency and its amplitude as the black holes get closer and closer together, orbit faster and faster, and then sometime around the peak of the amplitude of the gravitational waves, the two black holes merge, and you get this common horizon. You form a bigger black hole, and of course, at the beginning, it's very highly perturbed, right? It's like you had kind of two black holes coming together, so it's not a nice axisymmetric stationary solution. So it's going to have lots of these quasi-neural modes excited, but then they'll begin to decay down, and you'll see this quasi-normal ringing in the gravitational wave signal. But because this sort of quality factor is kind of order one, basically this will decay rather rapidly. You know, each oscillation, the amplitude is decreasing appreciably. So you just have a few cycles as this decays away. And so, you know, So basically, you know, this black hole perturbation theory and quasi-neural modes, you know, can help you understand, you know, what happens at the end of even very dynamical situations. And there's a lot of interest in, for example, being able to measure this ring down phase. And you can see from the formula that we derived that basically, you know, the real and imaginary frequency of all the quasi-neural modes is going to be completely determined by two numbers, the black hole's mass and the black hole's spin. So if you can basically measure more than one quasi-neural, if you can measure one quasi-neural mode, that'll basically independently give you some information about the black hole's mass and spin. You can, for example, compare to what you got for the from the gravitational wave signal in the N-spiral. That would give you kind of a check that you're using the right theory, that GR works. And if in the spring down phase you're able to measure more than one quasi-neural mode, you know, so in general this will be a superposition of several different quasi-neural modes. It's just that some will decay faster than others, but if you're able to measure several of them, that'll actually give you this independent check that basically the mass and spin implied by one is consistent with the mass and spin of another. So that's again a good check that GR is the right theory and a way to measure the properties of this remnant black hole. So people sometimes call that black hole spectroscopy. Okay, so I think we're out of time, but if you have any questions, please let me know. Yeah, so I guess our last class, next class will be our last class, and I'll plan to just give kind of a brief overview of some of the various topics in the field. But if there's anything particularly you want to hear about, let me know.
So in the extremal limit, you start getting that these like quasi normal frequencies don't decay, and then you get like a linear instability. Is that instability is just some like it's just that they don't decay and then somehow they start to like resonate in some way?
Yeah, like so as you go to extreme malady, there are these modes called zero damp modes where the imaginary frequency goes to zero as well. Yeah, and then at extreme malady, there's actually this instability known as the R-Takis instability, where basically like perturbations still decay kind of off the black hole horizon, but not on the black hole horizon. So these quasi-normal modes kind of get bunched up very close to the horizon in this extremal limit as well. So yeah, you have this basically, you know, things decaying away from the horizon, but not on the horizon. But if you take derivatives, they're in fact blowing up. And so yeah, that's what's known as the R-Takis instability. Any other questions? Well, happy to stick around if you